You to please join me in giving a warm welcome to Michael, a speaker from Evans, Georgia.
Hi, my name's Michael Earl, and I'm a female alcoholic. And it really is a pleasure to be here. A lot of people that I remember from when I lived in California, and I just have a special place in my heart for Barbara. I had back surgery, my second back surgery this year, and it turned out to be a lot more extensive than they expected. And I had rods and screws, and my spine was so unstable they had to anchor everything into my tailbone. And Barbara, with her own illness, got on an airplane. I just get so emotional. And she came and she took care of me in the hospital. And I just couldn't believe somebody would do that for me. You know, somebody in Oregon and I live in Georgia. And that's why I love long-distance sponsorship. You know, it's just always turns out, you know, when girls ask you to sponsor them and they live far away, it always works out because they're willing to go to any lengths. It has nothing to do with me. It's everything to do with them. They're willing to make long-distance phone calls. They're willing to keep commitments. They're willing to drive a couple states away if you're coming to speak. They're willing to fly to my house to do step work. And that's why it works. And not one of my out-of-state girls have ever taken a drink. But I'll tell you, nobody has been as important to me as Barbara. And she's just an inspiration. Just an inspiration, Anna. So very emotional. I don't know. I had a really bad asthma attack. I'm having asthma up here. I don't know if it's the rain or the mold or what, but I kept trying to. I forgot my inhaler, so Chris let me use his. And I got to tell you, I finally had to go in the bathroom and put my mouth on it, so it's my inhaler now. I'm sorry. I couldn't breathe. I had to put my mouth on it. I was trying to hold it out here and shoot it in there, and that's just not the way. I just couldn't get it, so I had to do it the way I do it. But so anyway, I'm breathing, but I've got really dry mouth, so please forgive me. You know, I don't know, but getting old is not for sissies. And I don't know. I'm just hanging in there the best I can, one day at a time. But I should be dead. I mean, I should be dead. If it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous today, I know I would be dead, because I'm the type of alcoholic woman who drank vodka down so much and so fast that I literally stopped breathing and had to be brought back to life. I got sober in California. Well, I drank in California. I grew up in California. And I now live in Georgia. I was speaking at a conference in South Carolina, and I met a Southern gentleman, and he just swept me off my feet. And I had a fairy tale romance, you know, where I was actually courted, you know, proposed to, given an engagement ring. I mean, I'd never been proposed to and given an engagement ring, and I'd been married 3 times. So this is my 4th marriage, and I'm telling it, and we got married before I lived with him, you know. So, I mean, just like it was supposed to happen. And but I'm telling you, when I made that move to Georgia, I almost had a nervous breakdown. It was such a culture shock. It was, if it had been Atlanta, it might have been different, but it wasn't Atlanta. It was Evans, a little suburb of Augusta, but it's right on the border of South Carolina, and deer hunting season, and I love animals, and by the time I'm up there, everybody's driving by with dead deer in their truck, and I mean, it was just more than I could handle, you know, so. But I started having panic attacks again. I used to have severe panic attacks, which I worked through in sobriety, and everything came back. And I kept begging my sponsor, Polly, to let me come back home. And believe me, my husband wanted me to, too. I mean, he didn't know. He'd never seen. He thought he had this real together speaker. You know, people put you on a pedestal. Let me tell you, we're sick. We're sick, just as sick as a newcomer. And he thought he had this real put-together speaker as a wife, and I started to have panic attacks and falling apart, and he was ready to send me back. But, you know, my sponsor wouldn't let me come back. She said, you know, you made a commitment as a sober woman. And not 1 year sober, not 2 years sober. You made this commitment, and you were 15 years sober. And now you have to stay, and you have to apply the steps of this program and the traditions of this program into your marriage. And I told her, I said, well, I think he wants me to leave. And she said, fine. She said, fine. If he wants to break up, let him leave. But you're staying, and you're to tell him that today. So I told him that. You know, he came into the bathroom, and I was in the tub, and I said, hey. My sponsor says I can't come home. And if you want out of this marriage, you're going to have to leave. I talked to him about the steps and the traditions, and we made a decision to stick it out, start having a meeting in our house once a month, applying the traditions in our relationships with couples. And I can tell you, we've been married 10 years, and the last 9 years have been absolutely the best years of my life. Considering all my surgeries and things that I've gone through, it doesn't matter. It's still, they've been the best years of my life. He's a partner beyond my wildest dreams. And there's not one person who knows Ted that doesn't just love him. Just love him. And especially the girls. You know, he's the father image that a lot of these girls never had. And I'm sorry he came down with the flu Thursday and he has been violently ill or he would be here. Hopefully he can make it to the workshop. Just so you can see what a wonderful Southern gentleman he is. And he gives you a bear hug that you just wouldn't believe. And I'm so blessed. I'm so blessed. I just can't believe that God loves me this much, that he loves me this much. We both, Ted and I are both very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. We love this program more than our lives. We always have newcomers living with us. We're always saying no more, no more, no more. But we always have them. And right now we're down to two and a half. I've got one girl that comes and she has a husband and a home, but she was having trouble staying sober. So she spends a lot of nights over at our house. So she's got her own little room when she's feeling shaky. So two and a half. And our limit's three now. We just, the house is just too crazy with more than three. Actually, it's crazy anyway. It's like Grand Central Station, but I wouldn't have it any other way. My husband and I work with a treatment center. And in Georgia, we're losing our treatment centers. We're losing our detoxes. In the Augusta area where I live, we do not have one detox to take a drink to. And so now I'm detoxing people in my house. And it's very, very scary. You know, I've had two people almost die on me. You know, I've had to go back to that chapter in the big book, working with others, and do the things that that they used to do. You know, we're not being handed these 30-day wonders on silver platters anymore. You know, we're having to go back to the roots of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it works. It works today just like it worked then. And we use discretion when we have newcomers living with us. We've learned a lot of lessons in 10 years on enabling people. And now we do what the book says. The book says use discretion. And so we watch them. We make sure we think we can offer them something and that they might benefit before we invite them into our home, because this is our home. And so it's working a lot better now than it did in the beginning. But, you know, in those 10 years, not once have we been ripped off. Not once. We've had really sick people in there, and some couldn't stay sober, but we still have never been ripped off. God just seems to take care of us. And I have valuable stuff in there. I have valuable archives of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I'm gone on trips like this, I always wonder if they're going to be there when I get back, but they always are. But anyway, there is one treatment center left, and it's for the military, and we're losing those treatment centers also. There's very few treatment centers for the military, and we just happen to live near Fort Gordon. And we've gotten permission to have these soldiers over to our house every Wednesday night to do a big book study, and they're there about 2.5 hours. So it's a wonderful experience. Barbara, were you there for? Yeah, Barbara was there. She got to experience some of the soldiers coming. Now it's a lot smaller than it used to be. It used to be, you know, like 30 of them, and now it's down to 10. But I am so thankful, you know, especially with having these back surgeries. You know, one of my favorite lines in the big book is bottom of 14, top of 15. It says, "For if an alcoholic fell to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive those certain trials and low spots ahead." So that sentence tells me two things. First of all, it tells me if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. I can pray, I can meditate, and I can go to church. But if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. And it also tells me if I'm not working with others, I'm not going to survive those trials and low spots ahead. And we are guaranteed trials and low spots. You know, life happens on life's terms. People still get sick. They still get old. They still die. None of us get out of here alive. Accidents still happen. Tragedy still happens. War still happens. And what's going to get us through these times is working with others. And I've had periods where I could not get out to a meeting, but I'll tell you, I had those soldiers come on Wednesday night, and when you're in the middle of a bunch of newcomers, and I mean really new, because some of them even drink while they're in the treatment center, it's just, you know, it's just what I need. You know, I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have that commitment and having them there every Wednesday night, and a lot of times on weekends and Christmas and Thanksgiving, we have them in our house, and I just feel like I owe my sobriety to the privilege of being able to work with these soldiers. Once we went to war in Iraq, it was really sad. We had soldiers with 28 days of sobriety being shipped off. And I went through a lot of stuff over that. And I give them all camel coins, and I give all the soldiers going over to Iraq a little teeny edition, the mini book of the big book. And I highlight a page, it's page 102, and it talks about being on the firing line of life, you know, and it talks about, you know, with special motives, God's going to keep you unharmed. And every time I read that paragraph to them before they leave, I mean, their eyes well up in tears. You know, I remember this one man being sent back for his second tour, and he said, "God, everything really is in the big book, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes, it really is." But I want to tell you an experience I had after I had just gone through this one surgery. I've had several surgeries besides the back surgery, and it's been embarrassing for me and humiliating for me, and the one most humbling thing I've gone through is this terrible weight gain. I've had a huge weight gain from steroids and being inactive when I used to be a runner, and also food, you know, because I can't do anything, so I'm going to eat. And but it's a humbling experience. Sometimes I feel like I don't want to get up here and share at an AA function because I just feel like you're not going to think I'm working step 6 and 7. Look at how fat I am. But so I'm humbled. I'm humbled coming before you with this weight gain. And, you know, it keeps me on my knees. It's a blessing. Sometimes those character defects keep you on your knees. And so I choose to look at it as a blessing today and not as something horrible. Now, tomorrow when I'm trying not to eat, it might be different. But anyway, I just had this surgery, and came Tuesday morning. They send you home right away. You're only there for one day, and they sent me home that night, late Tuesday night. And Wednesday morning, I woke up, and I had a fever, blood loss, stitches, chills. I was just sick as a dog, and I just told my husband, "I just don't think I can meet with the soldiers tonight." And the whole day I kept hearing my sponsor's voice. She used to always say, "You can be sick in a meeting as well as you can be sick in bed." And of course, surgery is different, and that would have been understandable. But, you know, I thought, well, I don't have to get dressed up and get in a car and drive anywhere. All I have to do is show up and get into the big book. And So I made the decision to meet with the soldiers. And we were on step two. And that's what I try to do with them in the period that we have, all out of the big book. Step one, first we go through the history, God's shots of the history. And then step one, step two, step three, on their knees saying the third step prayer, and I show them how to do a fourth step in hopes that they'll find a sponsor wherever they're going. And luckily, because of my speaking all over the United States, I know a lot of people where they're going, so I can set them up with sponsorship on the phone and nail them. After I learned that they wouldn't call them when they got there, I started making sure they called while they were still at my house. But anyway, we were on step two that night, and we had about 35 people. They were all in my, I call it my AA room, and all in the foyer. It was very, very crowded. And there was a gentleman sitting, I was sitting this way, and he was sitting this way, right next to me. And he just jumped up, and he's towering over me, and he started screaming at me that if there's a God, it's going to take a burning bush to prove it to him. And my first thought was, I can't believe I got out of bed for this crap. My second thought was, oh, God, help. I don't know what to say to this guy. And everybody is looking at me like, ooh, wow, what words of wisdom does he have? But I asked him his name again, and he said it was Lee. So that just reminded me of a man named Lee who wrote me a letter about a spiritual experience he had during one of my AA talks. Had nothing to do with me. It would have been another speaker if it hadn't been me. I'm not going to tell you that whole story. It's awesome, though, but it's too long. But anyway, I always close my story with how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today, and it was through a tragedy. My daughter was 3 years sober. I was 4 years sober. She was leaving an AA dance, and in the parking lot of the dance, a man came up to her and her girlfriend and forced these two girls in the car at gunpoint, and he kidnapped them. Brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours, and she was almost murdered. She lost her sobriety over it, lost her faith in God, and it really shook my faith. And talk about seeking. You know, I had to really seek God. And over the nine-year period, when I came to what I know as God today, I had several small spiritual experiences, but I always close my story, and what I was saying is that what I know for me today about God is that God is good, and good is God, and if it's not good, it's not of God. That there's a difference between man's world and God's world, and that kidnap happened in man's world. And for some reason, that brought about a spiritual experience for this man named Lee. And I was explaining all of that to this man named Lee. And I was on the part of the saying, I was saying, God is good, good is God. And we had shoved everything against the walls. I'm looking to see if you have a tree here. We had an artificial tree on both sides of the couch. And one of them was shoved against the wall next to a halogen lamp. Right straight across from him. And this is the honest to God truth. I'm saying God is good, good is God. The halogen lamp caught on fire and the bush caught on fire. I've got a fire in the corner of my house. And I totally forgot about his spiritual experience. You know, he just jumped up and he screamed O-S-H-I-T and started freaking out. And all I can think about is my house is burning down, and I'm in a sheer panic, and I'm screaming at the soldiers to help me get this fire out and unplug the lamp, and I was just in a panic about my house. So finally, those soldiers are so well trained, they just had it under control. They got the fire out and took the bush out and the lamp out and started getting some of the smoke out. And we all sat down again, and it was an energy in the room that I cannot describe. It was like every one of us got it at the same time. You could just feel it go around the room of the feeling, Oh, my God. This man demanded a burning bush, and God delivered it. And I'm telling you, there is not a chemical that you can put in your body that matches that kind of a high. I call it a spiritual high. And that spiritual high, it might have been his experience, but it really was an experience for all of us. And it lasted me, you know, throughout the week. I just felt like my feet weren't on the floor. I didn't have to take any pain medication. I didn't feel my stitches or my pain. I was just good to go. I mean, that's what that spiritual experience did for me. And I could have missed it. You know, I could have missed that. I could have used my surgery as an excuse to stay in bed. And I would have missed that. And these soldiers, this group was so transformed. They went back to the treatment center. The treatment center was so impressed with what happened and how all these soldiers were behaving that they started busing them to our house. Now this big white, it looks like one of those white prison buses you see on the highway with the prisoners getting off and pick. That's the kind of bus they put them on, sending them over to our house. Every night at 7 o'clock, they get there and these guys get off of this bus. And I live on a little cul-de-sac. And I mean, I know the neighbors are just freaking out. And no one wants to come out and, you know, really ask what's going on. You know? So sometimes they'll say something like, there sure is a lot of coming and going at your house. And somebody said something once, and I alluded to the fact that it was a Bible study. So you didn't want to break anybody's anonymity. But those are just some of the gifts, you know, the gifts in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you just suit up and show up. And what was just presented to me or just brought back to me, and if any of you care to come up and see it, people don't realize that they think Iraq is alcohol-free. Kuwait is, and a lot of those nations are, but Iraq is not alcohol-free. As soon as you cross over the border, they're selling you alcohol. They're trying to get the soldiers to buy alcohol. And so it's a real problem for the Iraqis and for the Americans. And what was presented to me is a chip from their first AA meeting in Iraq. And at the very bottom, it says, in accordance with the seventh tradition, which means they're registered. And it has the Iraqi flag, and it has the American flag. I don't know why it makes me so emotional. But it's called Serenity in the Sand. And I just remember it being at one of the internationals when Romania, for the first time, came on the stage with their flag, and how everybody just came unglued. You know, the whole stadium came unglued. And I just know that's how it's going to be for the next international when Iraq comes on the stage. On the stage with their flag. So, anyway, I'm so glad we have traditions that we don't have any opinion on outside issues. But anyway, I just feel just privileged to have these soldiers in my life, drunk or sober. Anyway, back to me. When I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. I always swore I was not going to be an alcoholic like my mom, and I made it for 25 years. Who were the people that were newcomers? Who here has less than 6 months of sobriety? Raise your hand. Oh, we have a lot of you. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. On New Year's Eve. We're not supposed to be here on New Year's Eve, but here we are. But I always like to tell newcomers that the absolute highest you get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. It is not a speaker, it's not a chairperson, it's not a delegate. The absolute highest you get in this program is sober, but there is a difference between being sober and being dry. I'd like to welcome those of you who are not so new but are having difficulty with this program. I saw a sign in an AA club that always gave me a lot of hope, and that sign says you're not a failure unless you quit trying. So please, whatever you do, just keep coming back. But I was told early on in this program that this program is not for spectators. This is a program of action. And those actions are the 12 steps as laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I come from a line of sponsorship that comes directly down from Dr. Bob, so I like to talk about Dr. Bob. One of the things he said, you know, he said if you simmer those 12 steps into two words, those two words would be love and service. And then he says, we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And he talked about kindness. And before he said that, he said, I want to emphasize the simplicity of this program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have little to do with our actual AA work. And I see a lot of things drifting in and out of AA today. They might not be Freudian, but they're just as useless. And what they do is they just complicate this very simple program. It's not an easy program, but it is a simple program. Coming down from the line of sponsorship, I like to talk about how we go through the steps, which is really basically out of the big book. But there's something you need to know. You need to know a little bit about the history of AA and how the big book was written and how we broke off from a religious organization called the Oxford Group that had a set of principles. And the drunks that started getting sober in there, it wasn't for drunks. They didn't like drinking, they didn't like smoking, and they didn't like us. Because a lot of the times we relapsed and testified, and we all smoked. And so it wasn't, we had a lot of problems with the Oxford Group not liking us. So that we broke off from the Oxford Group and took the principles. We gave them numbers and called them steps, and there were only six. And the third one was the moral inventory. And at the moral inventory, they took three actions that were very, very important at the inventory. One of them was going over their character defects at great length, because they really did believe you would drink over some of your character defects. They said the prayer to have those defects removed with their sponsor, and then they made that list of restitution, ways and means of making restitution to the people that we've harmed. So those were actions that they always took. And when Bill wanted to stretch those steps into 12, he took those actions, gave them numbers, and he just threw them in the book as steps. And so you will find 6, 7, 8, and the beginning of 9 all on one page, because they were in a hurry to get the book written. And so it doesn't talk very much about really 6 and 7. And that's where the 12 and 12 really enhances the big book. It was never written to replace the big book. It was really written for the traditions, but the steps were definitely to enhance the big book. And I know a lot of people just wanted to get rid of the big book and just do the 12 and 12, and it just I mean, for me, it just wouldn't work. But my favorite step in there is step 6, and Bill really spells it out in there. He says, God will not render you white as snow without your cooperation. And he says, the man that repeatedly works, and these are the words, that repeatedly works on his other defects of character grows the image of his creator. And because I hear people say they don't work on their character defects. God knows what they are, and when he's ready, he'll remove them. I mean, I'm 26 years sober in 23 days, and I'm fat. Now, I'm going to be dead before he removes that. I mean, if he doesn't do it pretty soon. I've had a lot of recovery in that area, so I'm really joking around. I've spent most of my time a size 6 before these surgeries. But I have found for me that I have to know what they are, I have to identify them, and then I have to do something to help God remove those defects of character. Or use them in a different way, use them as an asset. I mean, God can do anything, you know, with these defects of character. I've had a lot of them just removed, and I've had some of them just replaced. You know, my drinking's been replaced with compulsively doing AA. You know? So, but anyway, I am so thankful I had that kind of sponsorship. So the way I was sponsored, when I did step five, we did 6, 7, and 8 all at the same time. We did that part in the book where it says, go home, take the book from the shelf, you know, spend a quiet hour with God looking over the first 5 proposals. And we do that, but we don't go home and do it. I keep my sponsorees at the house in the AA room for that hour, and then I come back and we get right on 6, 7, and 8. And I know for me today I would be drunk if I wasn't sponsored that way, because I had some major character defects that would have driven me right out. And one of them was prostitution. The other one was stealing. And the last time I prostituted, I was 6 months sober on my 9th step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a lot of shame about that. And I didn't used to share it. And one day it accidentally came out, you know, and I cried and cried and cried afterwards. I couldn't believe I just told all these people what I did in AA. But so many women came up to me, I knew that it was something that needed to be shared. So that was the last time I prostituted, and I almost drank over it. You know, it's something that I had to have removed right away, and I had to do my part, and that was to stop. Stop doing it long enough for God to lift that way of thinking of how to take care of myself. And the other one was stealing, and it was habit for me to steal. I would steal and not even know I was stealing. It was such a habit. If I was in your house and there was money on the counter, it was in my pocket. And I wouldn't even realize it. I mean, it was such a habit. And I didn't know how I would ever get through that. And I had a sponsor that worked with me on it. You know, she made me call her every morning and commit for today not to steal. And then I was to call her at night and let her know if I was able to keep my commitment. And I can tell you from that day to this day, I have not stolen anything. I mean, that kind of action, taking that action of making that commitment, I was able to keep it. Some people are not able to keep it, and they struggle for a little while. But I was able to keep it. And then one day, it was so far removed, I can't even believe I was that person. It's just hard to believe, and that's why it's so important for me to get up here and share it, to remember where I came from, because after 25 years, you know, you can forget that you used to be like that. You really can forget. And the other one that's a real big one for me is, like I said, my eating. And what Bill says about that in the 12 and 12 is, he said, some of our other character defects are harder to remove than alcoholism. He says alcoholism is not a natural instinct. So when you're ready, God can just lift the obsession. But some of our other character defects are natural instincts that have gone amok. And there's no way God can remove a natural instinct, because he gave them to us for survival. And so Bill says sometimes we might have to settle for patient improvement. And that's where I am with my food. I've never had to reach 400 pounds like my daughter. I've never had to reach the weight of my mom. They both had gastric bypasses. And I think my daughter is very, very ill from hers. And I don't know if she'll ever recover, you know, all these illnesses she has from this surgery. So I am settling for patient improvement. And I know every day if I try, I'm not a failure. And I will one day be blessed again with... maybe not being a size 6, but being a size 10, next time I'll appreciate it, because I didn't appreciate it this last time. But I was, you know, really free of food, fat, and diet for 12 to 15 years when I lived in California. So I know it's possible. In the big book under Doctor's Opinion, it tells me that many types of alcoholics do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. So I'm here tonight to tell you that I'm one of those alcoholics. In fact, so is my mom. We both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort, different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil. But the good news is that today, that very same psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort, different times in different congregations, but the result was the same. And believe it or not, today, that very same minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to joke around and say, I think we probably drove these two men to drink. But the truth is, and this is the truth, my mom slept with a psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. My sponsor told me that was not exactly AA's idea of a spiritual experience. A little bit about my background. I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, and I'm illegitimate. And being born out of wedlock today is just not a big deal. But when I was a little girl growing up, it was. And my childhood is pretty appalling. So in my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her childhood. Because as bad as mine was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. And I lost my mom 13 years ago. She died of lung cancer. And I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. We had hospice come in. Thank you. I was trying to just pretend it wasn't there, but we had hospice come in, and my mom actually got to die with a little bit of dignity. I had the ability to get in bed with my mom, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch her drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And it's probably one of the hardest things that I've ever done. But one thing I learned from this experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things that I didn't want to be like, that I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. So that left my mom out on the streets at the age of 13 trying to raise herself. At the age of 14, she had her first baby, which she gave up for adoption. And then she had me, and she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man, got married, had three boys. We all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepfather moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise four little kids. And we were raised on welfare, and because of her drinking, we were raised in extreme, extreme poverty. Always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, being evicted, sleeping in cars. And I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with all of her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again. And this time she sent my three younger brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers were my very best friends. When you're sleeping in cars, always being evicted, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I already had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings were of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. The drunken psychiatrist pointed out to me I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away. My three brothers went away. My mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I have always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is first I learned that feelings are not facts. And all those things I used to think about myself were not the truth. And best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And the last 13 years, I walked through one of my biggest fears, and it's getting on airplanes. It took me 12 and a half years of sobriety to get on an airplane, and I found out that I'm not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. Now, my sponsor told me I'd better be clear on what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. You know, and I hear a lot of things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not in the big book. They're somebody's opinion. You know, and I have opinions, and that's why I quote a lot of pages, and I tell you things are in the big book, because I want you to know what's fact and what's my opinion. But anyway, there was this one man who used to always, actually it was several people, everyone he sponsored, I guess, that would always say that you could not have fear and faith at the same time, that if you had fear, you didn't have any faith. And I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in my program, because I still had all this fear. And I had worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. I've had spiritual experiences, but I still had all this fear. Finally, I went up to this man who was kind of like an AA guru, and I asked him, I said, what am I doing wrong in my program? Why do I still have all this fear? And he told me in the most arrogant, smug way, he says, well, it sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Today, I know I had taken a thorough third step. I know for me, it's much more to it than just saying, here, God, I turn my will and my life over to you. I mean, how do you do that? Do you just say it? I mean, for me, it was a process. And that process was taking those actions of 4 through 9. That's how I really actually started turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And how I continue to do that on a daily basis, I live in 10, 11, and 12 to the best of my ability. Finally, I went up to one of these old timers who was really instrumental in my sobriety, and he's so much like my husband. No, he wasn't near as nice as my husband. He was really gruff, but I just loved him. And I was kind of, I guess I was tattling on the other guy. I was crying on his shoulder and saying, he said that I don't have any faith because if I have fear, I don't have any faith. And he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it say that you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he pointed out a page to me. And it's page 68, and it's under the fear inventory. And I think for a long time I've been quoting the wrong page, and today it just dawned on me. And I might not have been, but it seems to me I've been saying 84, which obviously is the promises. But it's page 68, it's under the fear inventory. And that sentence says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me, you don't need courage unless you're afraid. Duh. And then he took me down to the bottom of that paragraph, and it gives you that little fear prayer. God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I always use that even today, and I'm always directed to help another person, whether they're in the program or out of the program. That's how I started getting on airplanes. You know, I looked for somebody I could help at the airport. I usually zeroed on little old ladies who are struggling with their bags. Sometimes it was embarrassing because they didn't know I was trying to be helpful. So it was kind of a little bit of a scene. And if I'm in a lot of turbulence on the plane and I'm just terrified, I always carry pen and paper with me. And I just, I'm strapped in. The stewardesses are strapped in, and you're not allowed to run around looking for someone to help. So I pull out pen and paper, and I start writing the third step prayer and putting other people in it that I know need prayer. Like I would put Barbara in it because I know she's struggling with some health issues. And I'd say, God, I offer Barbara to thee to build with her and to do with her as thou wilt. And I'll tell you, I had pages of the third step prayer by the time we landed. But I'm here to tell you that we landed every time, safe and sound. So that's how I kind of deal with that fear. But I mean, the panic attacks I've had are unbelievable. You know, unbelievable. The panic attacks I've had, I mean, my knees go out from under me and I literally collapse. And to have that freedom today is a gift. It's an absolute gift. And, you know, not being able to travel with my back problems, my husband and I drove everywhere, and so for 3 years I hadn't flown, and that fear came back. And I just had to, I mean, God's got a sense of humor, to get it all over with at once. I was asked to do a workshop in Iceland, and I had been in Iceland before, but it was in July at their first conference. Now it's a workshop for women, and all that fear is back, and so whatever could happen, happened, you know, with the planes having problems and flying into a blizzard and whatever. Got it over with, walked through it, and so now I'm back to being able to get on an airplane. But I'm telling you, I just knew I had to do that. I had to do that or I was going to be, you know, in that prison again, that prison of fear, and I just couldn't bear to go there again. So I'm pretty good to go now. The very last sentence in that paragraph says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. It does not say, at once we outgrow fear. It says we commence to outgrow fear. So I can tell you today, I'm almost 26 years sober, and I'm still commencing. You know, and that could be embarrassing, but it's covered in the big book under steps 10 and 11. Under step 10, it tells me that I'm to continue watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. It says it's not an overnight matter, that it should continue for a lifetime. And then it's reiterated in step 11, on retiring at night. There's a paragraph that gives us some instructions. And even though it's under step 11, that's how I do my tenth step. Yeah, and I do it in writing because I did my fourth step in writing. And there's seven questions, and I write on those questions. And the very first one is, were you selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? And then it says, do you owe an apology to somebody? Have you kept something to yourself that you should share with another person? My favorite one that it asks is, it says, what could you have done better? Because that has been a tool for me on changing my behavior. Because I can't change my behavior unless I know what I change it to. So if I write what I could have done better, and I might take a couple times of acting out and having to write that out again, eventually my behavior changed. And then it tells you to look for the good things. It says, were you packing into the mainstream of life? I mean, it's a constructive view, not a destructive view. Were you kind and loving towards all? Well, if I'm kind and loving towards 95%, I write about that. I'll say pretty good, 95%. And I've already covered that other 5% in the first question. So, and the very last part of it, it says we just ask God's forgiveness and what corrective measures need to be taken. Another thing in there that I love, it says we must be careful not to get into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that diminishes our usefulness to others. So once you do that work, I mean, it's uncover, discover, and discard. And that is my discard step. So I do my prayer and meditation, which is step 11, in the morning, because that's what it says in the big book. It says, on awakening. And so I quickly, on awakening, get on my knees and just say something really fast, like direct my thinking, divorce me from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. And then I have my coffee and settle down. And then I do some prayers with my husband. And then I do meditation on my own, where I try to listen to God. And that's very important for me to keep me centered. And I don't always get to do it, not every day, especially when I'm traveling. But I can tell. I can tell when I'm not doing it, you know, because I just don't feel centered. Anyway, when I was 13, my mom did have this baby, and I had to learn how to be a mom, and I didn't even know how to be a kid. My mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never, ever around. I had full responsibility of this little baby, and this little baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer. I eventually had to potty train her, bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. Now, after doing my inventory, I found out the truth was I hated school anyway. When I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers or I was teased about the way I dress and teased about my hair. And so specifically to get out of my home life at the age of 15, I got married. And the man I married was 18. He lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. And I have such a colorful life that I like to brag about this. I mean, I want everyone here to know when I got married, at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I truly did. I had these two TV shows I used to watch. They were my favorite programs. Most of you are too young to remember these. But it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. And these were family programs, very unrealistic, but I didn't know that. But they gave me high morals and high values. And all I knew is growing up, all I wanted was not to be an alcoholic like my mom and not to prostitute like my mom. So when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea that I was Miss Donna Reed, marrying Mr. Father Knows Best. And unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. And I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. One indication, his name was Johnny Walker. But I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer. Because when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism. And I blamed the way I turned out on the way I was raised. And after I got sober in this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine because she came from this very same background. And what my sister did, because she was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test. And she had to take it three times until she finally passed it. With this test under her belt, under a special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay. She bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach. And 13 years ago, at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Now, even today, sometimes I still don't get it. You know, same mom, same background, but different reactions. You know, and the difference is my sister is not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today I get to accept responsibility and I can no longer blame all those people, places, and things. Yes, I am an alcoholic and I do have a disease. But today I have a solution. And for me, part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions, and my present actions. So at the age of 15, I got married. At the age of 17, I did have a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism that I never experienced with my mom, and it's called physical abuse. And he never abused me unless he was drinking, but he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18. And that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do. Hadn't even taken a drink of alcohol yet. I always intuitively knew if I took a drink, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started out with me being a single mother living on welfare. My whole life growing up like that, I swore when I grew up I was not going to live like that. And there I was. Now, on page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So we're talking about the main problem being the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. So I know for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink because I've always had the mental obsession part of this disease. And I practiced it in the form of compulsive overeating. I'd shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol. And then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills. And that's back in the days when doctors gave really good amphetamines. Methadrine, dexedrine, it's all illegal today. But back then, I went on a diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink at the age of 25, I immediately had the physical allergy. From that very first drink, I had the phenomenon of craving. From that very first drink, I had a personality change. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you read about that in the big book. The big book refers to that as a real alcoholic. And I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol. When I consume alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts, and hives all over my body. And I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. If I had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink, I drank morning, noon, and night, and I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31. And this is not an exaggeration. I had a huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program. And it was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. And as a result of this spiritual experience, I sought out this church. And I counseled with this minister. I shared with him about my spiritual experience. And then I shared with him all my character defects and all my shortcomings. And this man assured me if I got really active in this church and I read all these inspirational books and I did all this positive thinking and all these affirmations, that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. After I got sober in this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're an alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're an alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I am absolute proof of that because I got really active in that church. I became the secretary of that church. And I struggled reading those books because I could barely read. I did all that positive thinking, constant affirmations. And the only thing that resulted is I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister. And it absolutely infuriated his wife. The rest of the congregation wasn't too excited about it either. Well, they were excited, but it wasn't the right kind of excited. But the one thing I'm going to share with you now is the one thing I thought I'd take to the grave with me. And I've done things worse than this, but to me this was the worst because it was stabbing God in the back. As secretary of that church, it was my job to handle the money. And when I handled that money, I stole part of that money. Now, at that point in my life, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt my only hope was God because I just had a spiritual experience. And I turned to God for help. And I ended up seducing his minister and ripping off his church. So I truly know the feeling of hopelessness that they talk about in the big book. And I'm going to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister. And I like to share this first story because it's the first time I was ever able to laugh at any part of my alcoholism. I always heard that laughter was healing, but I always thought my story was just much too serious. And when I got to this program, I always hung out at the back of the room. I have a friend named Teddy, and Teddy calls the back of the room the half-measure section or the denial section. Now, I didn't hang out back there for either of those reasons. I hung out back there because I couldn't read very well. I was terrified that they would ask me to read something. I literally could not say the word anonymity for over 6 months. So I'd always hide out in the back of the room. And in California, it's very theatrical, so we had some very funny speakers. And they would get up to the podium, share something funny, and everybody would just burst into laughter. And at first, I was absolutely incapable of laughing. But one day, after I had about 2 years of sobriety under my belt, I caught myself in the back of the room laughing too. But right after having this huge belly laugh, I found myself thinking, well, that might be funny for you, but there is nothing, absolutely nothing in my background I could ever laugh at. And then about 12 years ago or 13 years ago, I had just started speaking. I never shared my story till I was 11 years sober. I mean, this is one of the most terrifying things I've ever done, is get up here and talk at a podium. 4 years of sobriety, I could not get up here and read. So this is a miracle, standing up here talking to you tonight. It's an absolute miracle. I was going to give my second talk at the Seal Beach meeting. And my daughter wanted to come hear me. This is towards the time she was trying to get sober for the last time. And I can tell you today tomorrow she'll have 14 years without a drink. And I'll tell you, she got sober on Big Book sobriety, but she has chose not to stay here. She has not picked up a drink because she still practices these principles, but she is one miserable person. I've never seen such a tormented soul. But anyway, we had a lot of fun in the first years of her sobriety. But this was a time she was trying to get sober one more time, and she heard I was speaking at this meeting, and so she wanted to come hear me. And before the meeting, she brought some of her program girlfriends over to my house. We sat down and we had coffee, and then she proceeded to tell her girlfriends my drunkalogue. And for some reason, it's just the first time I was ever able to laugh at anything. For some reason, it was a little funnier coming out of her mouth than out of my head. Then, of course, she's talking about the minister. And I never thought about how some of this stuff looks through the eyes of a nine-year-old. She was 9 years old when I was seeing this minister. So she's telling these girls, I'm dragging her off to church every day. And she's learning things like the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule. I'm constantly preaching all this religious stuff to her. She comes home from school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door, and there, naked, in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. Now, when she first said this, I just felt all this embarrassment. I felt the shame and guilt. And I just looked at my daughter in the most sympathetic way. I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. My daughter just looked at me and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. And up until that time, I totally forgot he had an artificial leg. It was a huge leg. I don't know how I forgot it. But, you know, in ways that were important, he was not disabled. After I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working those 12 steps, I found for me, besides step 12, the most important step was step 9. Now, step 9 is the amends step, the step where we make restitution. And I recommend you do the first 8 steps before you get to step 9. I know some people come into this program, they take a look at step 9, it's so scary, they turn around and they leave. Other people come in and start right in on step 9 and make very inappropriate amends. I believe the steps are in order for a reason, and I believe this one in particular should be taken with the advice of a sponsor. But I call step 9 the freedom step. This is a step that truly freed me from the bondage of my past. And it's just not a coincidence that in the big book, those promises come after step 9. It says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. It says you won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9, thank God, because it took me 12 years. That happened to me with my very first amends, and that was going back to that church and telling that minister I used to steal from the church funds. And he told me he knew that. And I set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. I could never pay anybody back in one lump sum. I always had to set up payment schedules. I just took them in order. So I set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. Then I told him that I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower, and he told me he did not know that. So I made restitution to him. But the neat thing about this experience is he shared with me at that time he knew exactly what I was doing. By the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience, and that's what led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches, and I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous makes it real clear that this program owes a lot to both of these institutions. And in the big book, it says, if you need professional help, do not hesitate to seek it. But I have to tell you, for me, it was all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. So I'm 27 years old. I'm full on into my drinking. I'm living in an apartment I'm being evicted from. I had lights and gas had been turned off for a long time, but I still had a telephone. It was one of my working priorities. I got this call at 11 o'clock at night, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad. I barely knew this man's name was on my birth certificate. And he wanted to make amends for not being in my life. He wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. So he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family. And I did not want to go. I didn't have any desire to get to know him, but I didn't have anywhere else to go. I was being kicked out on the streets. And I think deep down inside, I did have this little hope that if I did this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado, and I lived there for 3 months. And in this three-month period, this man and his family could not wait to kick me out of the state of Colorado. In that three-month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his booze cabinet, ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. So my dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. I wrote this man a letter, and I told him I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to make restitution to him for my behavior. And I sent him a check trying to set up a payment schedule. And basically what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that said they didn't want my money and they never wanted to hear from me again. But I stayed sober. I was working with a sponsor. But on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him an appropriate card, and I would tell him I was still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still wanted to make restitution for my behavior. I did this for 6 or 7 years, and he would never, ever acknowledge me. Finally, in 1985 or 1986, I got a reply back, and I cannot tell you how excited I was when I saw the return address on this envelope. I ripped open the envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary out of the newspaper. He had just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't. But I took it real, real hard. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me that I don't make amends for approval. I don't make amends. The Big Book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked, because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm just so sorry he didn't get to know the person I am today, because I know he would have been proud. So, kicked out of church, kicked out of a state, back in Long Beach, California. And I don't have time to tell you the things I took my daughter through, but they were disgusting. It was just appalling and disgusting, the kind of mother I was. But what happened for me is I finally reached the point you read about in the Big Book. It talks about facing the four hideous horsemen. It wasn't the awful things I did out there that got me sober. It wasn't drinking vodka down until I died. None of those things got me sober. It wasn't crawling over to her school ground naked, telling her there was evil spirits in the house. That didn't get me sober. What finally got me sober was the feelings. You know, I just couldn't stand those feelings one more day. I woke up on my front room floor, and I felt those feelings of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I couldn't do it another day. I got on my knees, and I did the first three steps, and I didn't even know what the first three steps were. But I knew I was powerless over alcohol, and my life had never, ever been manageable. I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just knew he wouldn't because of what I'd done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, as I just got on my knees. And I said, God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that landed me in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so physically sick, I wouldn't have been able to sit through it. And an old timer bought me 2 beers just so I could make it through the meeting. And that's the last drink I ever had, and that was on November 10th, 1979. But because of that 10th tradition, we have no opinion on outside issues. I continue to do those diet pills. But when you're doing diet pills, you can do a really fast 4-step. So doing my 4-step, I realized that I was not sober if I was abusing those pills. So I gave those up January 23rd, 1980. That's when I celebrate my birth date. I'm 6 months sober. I'm on my 9th step. My sponsor told me I had to get a job. I have to be fully self-supporting through my own contributions. I don't know how to work, but I went out there, I got my first job, and I worked there for a total of 8 years, full-time, another 2 years part-time, after I took another full-time position, so I was there for a total of 10 years. In that first eight-year period, I went back to high school. I graduated from high school in 1985, and I was 36 years old. And I graduated with a cap, a gown, a real ceremony, and 450 18-year-olds. What I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for a musical theater corporation. It was Equity. Equity means union, which means that we dealt with big major stars. I went back to work, and within a period of time, I'd worked myself up to business manager of this multimillion-dollar corporation. And as business manager, I dealt with millions of dollars. And this is the honest-to-God truth. When I got to this program, I didn't have a clue how many zeros were in $1 million. I have participated in union negotiations. I've been invited into the homes of some of the most famous people you see even today on stage, screen, and TV. And even today, I see myself in a picture with a very famous person, and I still get overwhelmed. And I still think, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to being invited into some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step, and I applied these principles in all my affairs. Thank you. Right at 9 o'clock.